there's a quote on the internet that isn't attributed to anybody, but it says, "The saddest thing about betrayal is that it never comes from your enemies." This makes sense because your enemies doing you wrong is really their default mode. It's your friends and family members. Those are the ones who end up betraying us. Betrayal is so hard because it is more than just a flesh wound. It's a stab to the heart, or better yet, a knife to our backs. In the Game of Thrones, there are countless moments when characters are betrayed by those closest to them. And that's the theme that we're diving into this week. I'm Jim Parsons, and on behalf of Wes Smith, we thank you for listening. Please subscribe so that you can get the latest episodes when they go live. And if you don't mind, we would love it if you would leave us a rating and review on whatever platform you're listening to this podcast on, so the algorithms that run the world will learn that you enjoy listening. We encourage you to continue the conversation by heading to our Facebook page, facebook.com/theologyof, or email us at theologyofpodcast@gmail.com. Let's get to episode 3 as Wes and I discuss the theme of betrayal in Scripture and the Game of Thrones on The Theology of.
This week's episode of, well, maybe not this week's, it's not a weekly series, but this episode of Theology of Thrones is focused on betrayal. And if you watch really more than like one episode of Game of Thrones, you're going to see an example of betrayal. In fact, really kind of what moves the series along, pushes the plot, are acts of betrayal. That happens consistently throughout the series, from the end of the first season, which sees Littlefinger betraying Ned Stark to the Lannisters, and then Joffrey betraying Ned, kind of deciding on the spur of the moment to execute Ned instead of sending him to the wall. I mean, Jim, it's been years since that first season. I guess we don't have to say spoiler alert, do we?
No, I think if you're going to be listening to this podcast, you have already watched the entire, or at least most of the series. So if you're expecting not to have stuff spoiled, then I don't think you should be listening.
Right. I mean, all the way from, you know, season one through the final season, we're going to be pretty open about what happens in this series. And if you have not seen Game of Thrones, a couple questions. One, why are you listening to this?
We're still glad you're listening, but why?
I mean, glad you're here. And two, what have you been doing with your life? I mean, if the answer is serving Jesus, that's acceptable.
Yes, I guess that would be.
I'll accept that. But if you're going to understand anything we're talking about, you need to watch the series. Nice. There are plenty of examples of betrayal, and Jim and I are going to talk about just a couple of them. We can't really talk about all of them. We're going to really kind of go into that much detail. Even just researching kind of the betrayals that stick out in my mind, it kind of unravels this intricate plot with all kinds of details, which is kind of Game of Thrones kind of thing. That's kind of what it does. But we'll hit some of those when we talk about betrayals. But Jim, what, when you think about the series, what betrayal kind of sticks out in your mind?
Yeah, I mean, I guess the one that pops up first, just because it's been the most recent one, is, you know, and here's a huge spoiler alert because it's really the last episode, is Jon and Daenerys, when Jon kills Daenerys. And, you know, it was that last season is kind of playing up on Jon and Daenerys' relationship. They didn't know they were related to one another at first, and then they do, and still the passions continue for them. But after Daenerys has kind of laid waste to King's Landing and settled into her new role as Queen of the Seven Kingdoms, she kind of unveils to Jon her idea of what she's going to do with the rest of the kingdoms and take them by force and just kind of lay waste to the kingdoms again. To all the different ones. And you can see that his heart is being pulled towards his people, the North where he grew up, and the Starks. And he just has, you know, battling these feelings of wondering what he should do. He's in a position where he's right next to the queen, but, you know, feels like there has to be something done. And so in that last scene, what, they embrace, they kiss, and then Jon stabs her right then and there. He must have good aim because, I mean, she dies pretty quickly after that, and right in his arms. And his her last dragon is sitting there watching this whole time. And I remember watching that scene going, all right, is he just going to chomp down on John or what? What's going to happen? But I mean, John kind of betrays Daenerys in that moment just because she thought he was a loyal subject, companion, however we want to put that. There's definitely a power struggle there, but was definitely loyal, but then in the end betrays her because, you know, he thought she was going too far and taking it a little bit too extremes, to say the least.
Right. And a couple things about that last scene. One thing is, like, no matter what John had decided in that moment, he was betraying somebody.
Right, yeah.
You know, if he had went along with Daenerys' plan, I mean, I don't know if you call it a plan. It's not really much of a plan, actually. Right. But if he had gone along with Daenerys, he was betraying Sansa and Arya and Bran.
Mm-hmm.
And really betraying all of the Seven Kingdoms.
Yeah.
By choosing to kill Daenerys, I mean, it's a betrayal, but it's almost like, you know, it feels a little bit to me like the lesser of two evils. And, you know, that's the kind of thing I was kind of keeping track of, like, spoiler alerts, like, or, you know, looking for spoilers and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I tried, like, I had these grand ambitions to not, like, get sucked into, you know, spoiler videos on YouTube.
Right.
For, like, Game of Thrones and for Star Wars or Marvel movies or whatever. And that lasts, like, you know, half a day. And so you kind of saw where the thing was heading. You saw.
Yeah.
It wasn't a shocking betrayal.
In the list of shocking betrayals in the series, I don't think this is definitely one of them. Although I do have to say it's probably one of the most controversial ones. I don't think the internet has settled down since.
No.
And it'll probably go on forever. Is like this the way they thought things were going to end?
And part of that too is, I think for two reasons. Not that we're going to get into a Game of Thrones like. You know, criticism here.
Right, right.
But I never bought the chemistry between Daenerys and Jon. That could have been the actors, but I never felt like they, you know, with Jon and Ygritte, the wildling girl he fell in love with, you felt that chemistry. There was a playfulness.
Right.
There was an organic kind of feeling to that relationship. But with Daenerys, it was like these two powerful characters were thrust together and they both are pretty people. So obviously they have to be together.
Right.
And of course, you know, let's just say it, you know, incest is not really a thing in the, you know, the Game of Thrones world. It's not like
it might be. It's just not figured into relationships.
Yeah, nobody flips out when people say, oh, that's his aunt. Ooh, gross. Nobody does that.
Right.
But also, like, I think the action or the plot in season 8 was so so rushed by necessity. You know, they could have really, like, three additional episodes to season 8 could have done wonders.
You could have, yes.
So it felt like things were so rushed that there wasn't kind of the attention to detail and the depth put into that betrayal that there was, say, for one I'm going to talk about with Theon Greyjoy, or with Littlefinger. Like, the last, you know, Littlefinger's death was very rewarding.
Oh, yeah.
Because those seeds had been sown from the very first season. But yeah. Anywho. So back to Jon and Daenerys. What did you, when that happened, what were you, like, what was your immediate response to that? Like,
well, I mean, I agree with you. I wasn't in shock. It was kind of you kind of saw it coming that Jon was probably going to have some kind of debate or decision that he had to make, and I mean, so it wasn't necessarily shocking. I think after 8 seasons of other betrayals, which we'll get into some of them, you know, or other moments where you're like, what just happened, it wasn't necessarily like, oh, this is something completely new. And you know, I figured after her and is it Dagon, is that his, is that the no Dragon, the dragon's name that was left. After they laid waste to King's Landing, I mean, I was kind of like, all right, she's slipping into that kind of mad queen mode. And somebody's going to have to take her out because that's not going to, it's just not going to work.
Is it Drogon?
Drogon, that's it. Yes, thank you. So yeah, it's, I wasn't necessarily surprised at all, but it was a moment where I was sitting here, what's next, with Drogon right there in the throne room with him.
That was, and of course, because I looked this up, there had been a rumor floating around that Drogon was going to melt the Iron Throne. And so, in that moment, first of all, I got to say, full credit to the show creators, the special effects in that scene.
Oh, it's unbelievable.
The level of detail with that dragon, like, is as good as anything I've seen, television or movie.
Yes.
I mean, that was just mind-blowing. And, of course, we can talk. I think we're going to have a future episode about power.
Yes.
And so we can talk about the symbolism of melting the throne. But, yeah, that's kind of like... I think in years to come, when people think about Game of Thrones, this because I know they're doing at least, you know, they're doing another series. I mean, I imagine it's in season one's probably in post production right now. They're doing another series, and I'm sure there'll be other series to follow. Mm. And so when people look at this initial run of like Game of Thrones, the initial series, I think three betrayals are going to stand out. But, as vividly. One is the one we've just talked about with Jon killing Daenerys. And I think the Red Wedding is going to be the standout betrayal scene. And I also think Ned's death will be something that sticks in memory as a betrayal. And, initially, as we were talking about what we wanted to discuss in this episode, I wasn't saying we shouldn't talk about the Red Wedding, but kind of my point was we don't have to do a real deep dive on the Red Wedding because everybody, if you watch this series, that's the thing. Like, and I know for a lot of people, like there are a lot of people who were watching Game of Thrones, and when the Red Wedding happened, they stopped.
Right.
And that happened to me with the books. Like, I was reading the books, and Robb Stark, I was team Robb Stark.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I was ticked off in the books because I read the books. I just checked one out from the library on a lark before I even knew they were going to do a series. And I was reading to the end of the book, just kind of skipping along, and then all of a sudden, Ned is executed. And at that point, I thought, that's really shocking but really cool.
Mm-hmm.
And then I got to the point of the Red Wedding, and I'm like, man, forget this series. This is stupid.
Right.
Because in the books, probably more so in the series, Rob was kind of, if memory serves, Rob was just basically looked like Ned Part 2. Like,
yeah. He was the first son to take over, and he was going to avenge his father's death.
Yep.
And they were kind of setting up as the Starks versus Lannisters. And so, yeah, but I mean, I remember watching the Red Wedding, and I was like, what just happened? And, like, how did they get rid of all those people? And why?
A couple years later, came back to the books once the series had started. And of course, knowing it was coming when you're watching the series, if you read the books, when you knew it was coming. Right. And so it didn't, for folks who are readers, it didn't have that kind of shock value. But I still love going back and watching reaction videos.
I was watching some of those today. They're awesome.
Especially the Burlington Bar. up in New York City, their reactions, like, pretty great. And seeing people get like legitimately ticked off, like angry, and I love that. but so Red Wedding, yes. That, and in terms of like, to me, like if you want to look at the central event that set up every other thing that happened in the series. I mean, the Red Wedding is top of the list. That's kind of like,
yes,
that set things in motion that just, was the rest of the series basically.
Yeah. Well, you can, and up to that, you can kind of, when Ned dies, that was kind of a moment where you're like, oh, what, why? But then when the Red Wedding happens, it just kind of blew everything out of the water.
Yeah.
Where you're like, oh, wait a second. Now this place or this series, who knows what's going to happen because they killed off all the major characters.
Yeah, and you know it's that feeling of now they kind of shied away from this the last three seasons, but this feeling of when they killed Ned and then when they killed Catelyn and Rob, like this feeling that no character is safe.
Right.
But really, after the Red Wedding, I don't think there were any other major deaths that were as shocking, with the exception of the cliffhanger with Jon Snow.
Yeah.
But even then, like, you knew, it's almost like with Avengers Infinity War, when those characters were, you know, they weren't killed, they were dusted by right. Thanos. Like, you've already seen the trailer for the next Spider-Man movie, so you know they're coming back.
Right.
So, Jon Snow, there weren't, you kind of had a sense, well, okay, there's going to be a swerve on top of the swerve.
Right.
So, and they had already had the precedent of people coming back to life. So mm-hmm. you kind of saw that was going. But when they killed Ned and then with the Red Wedding, like when they killed Ned, you might be kind of thinking like, okay, we're safe. We're good here. But then the Red Wedding just kind of said, you know, this show is a different animal.
Yeah.
Don't get too attached. But then after that point, every character, like at least me personally, every character I was attached to survived.
Right, until the last season.
Until the last season.
You figured a bunch of people were going to die that time anyway.
Yeah, they have to. I mean, it's
yeah.
Why not? But I think for me, like, the betrayal that feels like the most, I guess, real or authentic or kind of that was the, maybe even the saddest, was Theon Greyjoy.
All right.
And one thing I do love about the final season is I do love that he you know, was redeemed.
Yes.
And talked about that last episode. But, and even going back and looking at some of the information about Theon's journey, just, you know, he's kind of creeping up my list of, like, favorite Game of Thrones characters.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's no way for me he's going to overtake Davos Seaworthy or Seaworth mm-hmm. or Tyrion.
Right.
But he's probably in my top 10. And he started out kind of as a ward of the Stark family and basically presented as like one of the guys, one of the brothers. Although, you know, you find out as things progress, he was really basically taken prisoner, kind of as like as insurance.
Mm-hmm.
By the Starks, they, you know, they kind of quelled the Greyjoy Rebellion. And Theon was next in line to be the king. And Ned took basically adopted him and said, if you try anything else, you lose Theon.
Mm-hmm.
And so I don't know if Theon ever, I can't remember if Theon learned the details of that whole thing, but he always kind of knew he was an outsider. And again, this is where the specifics fail me. I'm currently looking at a webpage about this, but Theon, when the whole thing goes down with Ned's death and the Red Wedding, you know, Theon for a little bit remains loyal to Rob, but then Theon sent back to the Iron Islands to persuade King Balon to join with the Starks. But Balon instead intends to conquer the North while the army is fighting in the Westerlands. I'm reading this, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
Theon is insulted when he's given command of a single ship, so he thinks he should have more. He thinks he deserves more command, but he's only given one ship. And he kind of goes back and forth. He contemplates warning Rob, but remains loyal to his family. And he has his own ship, and none of his crew respects him at all.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, they think he's just some punk who doesn't have any experience, which is kind of true.
Yeah.
He's
a little spoiled.
Yeah, he is, and you know, he's a bit of a jerk. But he decides he's going to prove himself by capturing Winterfell. Actually, his first mate suggests this to him, that he prove himself by capturing Winterfell. And he does this, and he basically kills two young children and then tells you know, kind of passes them off as the bodies of Bran and Rickon Stark.
Right.
And he burns these two little, basically just two farm boys, and passes that off as Bran and Rickon. And then, I mean, it gets a lot more complicated, but eventually he is captured. He's on the run, and he's captured by Ramsay Bolton. And you know, that's when, there for a little while, Game of Thrones becomes a horror movie. Ramsay, I mean, he's neck and neck with Joffrey for, like, the worst person.
Yes.
In Game of Thrones. Just the actor who portrayed that is so effective, like, just pure evil.
Mm-hmm.
And basically brutally tortures Theon, you know, basically just, he's completely dehumanized, robbed of his individuality and personality and his manhood. Mm-hmm. And then... I believe his sister rescues him, correct? Yara winds up rescuing him. Is that
That sounds right. And you know, I honestly don't remember.
If it didn't happen, I want it to happen because Yara was awesome.
Yara was great.
I mean, she's kind of like, I think she's like, Theon looks at her and thinks like, that's what I should be.
Right.
But Yara is just, you know. She's a great fighter and leader and all that stuff, but Theon begins a long journey back and is killed by one of the White Walkers defending Bran, and it's very poignant because at some point, I believe in season two, when Theon is kind of taking control of Winterfell, Bran, you know, who's paralyzed, of course, looks up at him and says, "Have you always hated us?" And at that point, Bran's like 11 years old, something like that.
Right.
And it's just like, really, that's a heartbreaking scene.
Mm-hmm.
So that betrayal is a very personal one. But what's interesting, one of the things I do love about this show, that betrayal, it's so powerful because the writers, and of course George R.R. Martin, but also the writers of the series, take the time to show you the psychological kind of motives behind what Theon does.
Right.
So it's not out of the blue. It's understandable why Theon would feel like he has to do this. And, you know, given Theon's lack of experience, he bungles it and sets him on a course where, you know, he gets paid back for his betrayal. But it's just a great, to me, that's the most like realistic look at betrayal in the whole series.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's my pick. Yeah. And Red Wedding, of course, but you know.
Well, I mean, I think I agree. Red Wedding was just, it was, you know, the low hanging fruit, and we could figure this other stuff out. Well, speaking of somebody who kind of looked up to someone and then was betrayed by him, I go to Ollie and the Night's Watch as they execute Jon.
That's hard to watch.
Yeah, I went back to watch that scene, and you're talking about the pauses and the writing to look at the emotional attachments between two characters in this moment where Ollie knew exactly what he was supposed to do because the Night's Watch are right there telling him. But then also, you know, through that relationship. Well, let me sum it up right quick before we get into that. So Jon is over on the other side of the wall and hanging out with wildlings, and then needs to bring them, basically, he makes a decision to bring them to on the other side of the wall and to save them from the White Walkers. Jon knows that, you know, the White Walkers are coming and they're just going to just lay waste to these people that he was accepted into, fell in love with, and kind of connected with. And as he does so, the Night's Watch sees that as utter treason and betrayal on Jon's part. To who he is as a member of the Night's Watch. Was he the leader by then? I forget.
I think he was.
You know, as their leader, he's just, you know, betraying them by letting them through. But Ollie, he was saved during a raid, and Jon was bringing him on, kind of grooming him, like Jorah Mormont was doing to Jon when he was Ollie's age. And kind of getting him ready to kind of be his, well, he was his personal steward and training him and that sort of thing. So there's this relationship between Ollie and Jon. And in that last moment, after, you know, it's a pretty brutal scene where you one leader of the Night's Watch after another are just walking up and stabbing John and, you know, whispering in his ear, "For the watch." And Ollie's the last one. You know, John's on his knees and he looks up and he says, you know, "Ollie." And then Ollie stabs him and says, "For the watch," with tears, you know, puddling up in his eyes. So, you know, it was layered, which is, I think, some of the brilliant writing of the emotions attached to characters to one another. But then also, you know, who's betrayed who in that moment? Is it John who betrayed the Night's Watch by letting the wildlings, people they hate, through the wall? Which he thinks is a great decision because it's going to save thousands of people. It's also going to not increase the White Walker's army after they die and then come back to life.
Right.
So, you know, it's practical and humanitarian. But then he also, once again, is forced to make a decision between, you know, saving people he loves and also saving people that are – or following people that he's attached to. This kind of follows John's character around, I guess, after looking at Daenerys and him too. That he's always stuck in between people and what their roles are and what to do.
Right.
But to me, that was one of those moments where, you know, it set up the whole John's death and then resurrection. But the actual death scene, I thought, was one of the most – was, if you can have a favorite death scene, that's not like for – because a character's horrible.
Yeah.
Not like, woohoo, finally he's died, he's dead. But, you know, kind of like, wow, that was – it was a meaningful death scene, I guess you could say.
Yeah.
Just the way they did it. It wasn't like somebody, like in the Red Wedding, just walking up and slitting someone's throat. It was this, you know, intentional stabbing by other people to show the how treasonous he was.
Yeah. And it's – like, and just thinking back to, like – that's when this show is at its best, is when things are not spelled out. You know, like when you can understand why the Night's Watch, you can understand where they're coming from. Like I know I can't remember the guy's name, but like the main leader of kind of that group that killed John.
Right.
You know, a lot of his stuff was like personal pride. He felt that John kind of, you know, replaced him.
Right.
But the idea that, you know, it's you know, and it's basically like just politics, like, or just leadership, not politics mainly, but just leadership. Like, you're going to make decisions. You're going to have to make decisions that that people who you're leading don't agree with. And, you know, the thing about the Night's Watch, I think in their mind, they're doing what's noble.
Right.
And so I think you're right. That is a really powerful one. And again, the show at its best when all these kind of intricacies of kind of political motives, personal motives, psychology, because Ollie was really, had been back and forth, really confused about what he should do. And,
right. You know, you can read it all over the actor's face, which is brilliant.
Absolutely. So, yeah. Good choice.
Yeah. Well, you got one more? Or is those it?
And this is not so much not pointed to one. I mean, you can point to one instance, but Littlefinger, like.
Oh, he betrays people all the time. That's his thing.
he eats breakfast and betrays people.
Yeah.
but then again, like, you expect it. Like, you know that's who he is.
Well, that's what he tells Ned Stark right off.
Well, yeah. And which is why it, you know, Ned is not like. You know, I have heard people say Ned's like the dumbest character. But he just operates he doesn't operate by intrigue or deception. He operates by kind of integrity and honor.
Right.
And the perfect kind of guy for somebody like Littlefinger to manipulate. But the whole scene where his betrayal leads him, when he's standing before Sansa and Arya, he's trying to get Sansa to betray Arya. And I mean, we gotta get to the scripture stuff here in a moment, but that whole scene is just brilliant. And
so in the end, in like the throne room where they're trying to play one another.
Yeah.
In Littlefinger's last scene.
Yep.
Yeah.
And then when Sansa says, she lists out these charges that could be charges against Arya.
Right.
Like, it's phrased in a way that she could be talking to Arya. And Littlefinger is kind of off to the side, and then she says, how do you answer these? And Arya is standing right in front of Sansa. Says, how do you answer these charges? And you kind of pause for a beat. Lord Baelish. Mm-hmm. And then, I think that's one of the few times I actually, stood up. oh, holy crap, yes! And
Right.
Betrayal has consequences.
Yes. So. Well, that's one of my favorite. I love that scene too, and I remember watching it, going, "Oh, is he going to get away with this again? You know, is he going to be able to maneuver these two and, have these sisters disagree with one another?" But then in the end, when they come together, I'm like, "Oh, yes."
And it's also because when I meet someone, I like to play a little game, just repeating what kind of his advice to her is just that. That was brilliant. A deft touch.
Yes, I love it.
But then again, I know we got to transition to the next to where we see these themes in scripture. But you could talk. This show is so built on betrayal. In some ways, betrayal and naked ambition are kind of what is the engine that runs this show.
Yeah.
And so it's And I will say they found a way to do that without making it predictable or repetitive.
Yeah, and you were when those betrayals happened, you were attached to people, mm-hmm. or you were finally in the fact with Littlefinger, you were cheering on Arya and Sansa, going, "Oh, finally somebody got it." So they were an integral part of the whole series, which I think we'll get to in the very end of this podcast, but I think is a good reflection of life too.
Absolutely, absolutely. Yeah.
Let's pause and we can. Oh, go ahead.
Well, I was going to say Tyrion and Tywin, that whole thing. Just another great betrayal. But, again, if I sit here long enough, I'll think of a bunch more. So we probably need to move on.
Well, let's transition into where we see betrayal in scripture. All right, well, let's just go ahead and name it. I think, if the Red Wedding is the low-hanging fruit for this series, Judas would be the low-hanging fruit in the Bible when we're talking about betrayal. So let's just go ahead and talk about Judas for a second and kind of get him out of the way.
Judas was one of the 12 disciples of Jesus. He was, interesting little detail, is actually the treasurer.
Mm-hmm. It's where always the trouble starts is when you start dealing with money.
Yeah, with money. Yeah, that you get access to the purse, man.
Yeah.
Do a little biblical deep dive here. His name given is Judas Iscariot. That title, Iscariot, could be related to a group of Israelite Hebrew warriors called the Sicarii. Which is Latin for little dagger. And this group is like the first century equivalent of suicide bombers almost.
Right.
These were people who would, it's like a group of zealots. They were called the zealots. They were zealous. Then today we call them terrorists, but these Sicarii would go into marketplaces and at a set time in a coordinated attack, they would pull out their daggers, kill like centurions or officials, and then kill themselves. And so Iscariot is similar to Sicarii. That's not conclusive. It's one kind of hypothesis out there that actually what motivated Judas to betray Jesus was kind of this zealot political agitation that wanted to see the Jewish people overthrow the Romans. And so Judas thought by betraying Jesus, he was kind of forcing Jesus' hand, so to speak.
Yeah, he wanted to actually have Jesus do what he thought Jesus was there to do.
Right.
Defeat the Romans.
And which is not, obviously, as it turns out, not what Jesus was planning.
Right.
But I don't really think it casts Judas in. I don't think it helps Judas at all. It'd been much better, much better for Judas to say, "Hey, Jesus, what if I did this?" And then Jesus says, "No."
Right.
But instead, Judas, you know, I think what makes it such a betrayal is kind of the secrecy in which Judas operates. I mean, of course, there's the detail that at the Last Supper, Jesus knows what's going to happen.
Right.
That might move us into a discussion we don't necessarily have the time or the space to have here. No. But
right. Yeah, I agree. But and then, you know, led to the garden, betrayed with a kiss. You can see there's remorse in Judas, too, because he then goes out and hangs himself or is hung.
Hangs himself.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's tragic. Tragic for him because of the end result of his life. But still, the idea of being able to force Jesus' hand and being one of the 12 that he called together. The fact that he could, you know, even if that link, like you mentioned, with Iscariot was to kind of these suicide terrorist type people, the fact that that is a person that Jesus welcomed into the fold, into his 12 disciples, is, right, to me, speaks very highly of who Jesus is and
yes,
how ragtag of a group these disciples were.
Right.
So to have that type of person who's welcomed in and accepted to then turn around and try to force your hand, which leads him to the cross and his own death, I think, you know, is the what we normally go to when we think of betrayal in the Bible. But there are other areas.
Yes.
So what else you got? What else comes to your mind?
Well, if there's one storyline, or kind of one character's story in the Bible, in the Old Testament, that you could take that storyline, change the names, and put it right down in the Game of Thrones universe, it would be David.
Right? Oh, yes.
Like it is like Game of Thrones, a lot of twists and turns, palace intrigue,
good and bad,
unexpected narrative, you know, bends in the road, and also, you know, plenty of gratuitous sex and violence, family connections, that kind of thing. It's just it's David's storyline, and I'll try to briefly as possible to kind of hit the high points for the sake of the trail. David was seventh son of Jesse. I believe it was seventh. And Saul, King Saul, Saul was named the first king of Israel, and Saul disobeyed God. And so God sent the prophet Samuel to go find the new king. And he led Samuel to Jesse's house in Bethlehem. And David was the youngest son of Jesse and was basically like the little runt of the family out tending sheep, which was like the lowest job you could do.
Right.
Like, you know, I guess like, you know, taking out the garbage, cleaning the litter box kind of stuff.
The little brother job.
The little brother job. And so, which is a great story for another time, but David is, God tells Samuel this is the next king, it's David. And then shortly thereafter, David is, finds himself kind of as part of the inner circle, mainly because he kills Goliath, which kind of like another famous biblical story that most people know about. David kills the giant, and then David is also a great musician. It's kind of like a singer-songwriter, so like he's also like the James Taylor of the Old Testament, I guess. But David, apparently Saul has these really bad, debilitating headaches, and the only thing that brings him comfort is David singing and playing. So David does this and eases Saul. And another connection here, Saul is like the mad king of the Old Testament. Saul basically loses his mind and, in something of a betrayal, attempts to kill David a couple of times and is paranoid that David is going to betray him. David remains faithful to Saul. But Saul's reputation is diminishing. David's is rising, and David and Saul's son Jonathan are best friends, which gives David an inside track on Saul's, you know, machinations. And then Saul is killed in battle, or falls on his sword in battle. And then David becomes king, and we get, at some point after this, we get betrayal number one, major betrayal number one, where David sees a woman, Bathsheba, bathing on her roof, and David basically is like, I want her, and has his men go get Bathsheba, who is married, and he sleeps with Bathsheba. She gets pregnant, and David finds her husband Uriah and tries to convince Uriah to go sleep with Bathsheba to cover up his own sin. And to, you know, when Bathsheba wants, everybody realizes Bathsheba's pregnant, he can say, well, it must have been Uriah, whatever. But Uriah refuses because, you know, he, I guess, is the Ned Stark of the Old Testament. Because
honorable.
Honorable. I'm not going to go, you know, lay with my wife while my men are, you know, in the barracks on the battlefield.
Right.
You know, that kind of thing. And David even tries to get him drunk. Doesn't work. And then he has Uriah placed on the front lines and gives his general an order to pull all the troops back and leave Uriah alone. Uriah is killed, and David takes Bathsheba as his wife. Just a very sordid tale, which is very Game of Thrones-ish in its kind of just horribleness. But David is confronted by Nathan and basically says, you're going to pay a price. The sword will never leave the house of David. And then a few years later, David's son Absalom stages a rebellion, betraying his father, and Absalom is killed. And so basically David's story is almost betrayals, attempted betrayals, actual betrayals, and everybody pays a price.
Mm-hmm.
And so this kind of connection between betrayal and ambition and power, but also, you know, kind of the idea what the prophet Nathan tells David, you know, it's basically you live by the sword, die by the sword. The sword's not going to leave your house.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you raped Bathsheba, took what didn't belong to you, and you committed violence to cover up your own sin. You betrayed a faithful, honorable man to cover up your sins.
Right.
So that's, again, that storyline. I mean, if I change character names, you can convince people this is a plot of the next Game of Thrones series.
Oh yeah. So yeah, you could almost frame it as Game of Thrones is very Old Testament-ish.
Yeah, I mean, between that and the Book of Judges, I mean,
right.
Why they haven't made like a Game of Thrones style series out of the Book of Judges, I don't know. I mean, it's right.
I'm right there with you. That's anybody who thinks the Bible is boring, and there's some boring parts of the Bible, but there are some pieces that you're just like, what? And Judges is, and I love David's story. To me, it makes him extremely human because that's, you know, that's the lineage that's tracked to find out who Jesus is.
Yeah.
You know, they still claim, you know, from the house of David. Even though he did the horrible things he did, and you know, he's still part of God's heart and God's plan.
Yeah, it's David is a fascinating character.
We'll probably in the rest of this series or this season bring him up a lot because there is that huge correlation between Game of Thrones and his life and the decisions he makes.
Exactly, and it's and kind of what we were talking about beforehand is having to figure out, you know, obviously Judas is the obvious example.
Right.
And David and Bathsheba and Uriah and David and Absalom are good examples of betrayal.
Mm-hmm.
But when you kind of really dig into what constitutes betrayal and what do we mean by that? And so I was thinking, like, how would we define that word and what rises to the level of betrayal? Like, kind of what we were talking about earlier is, to me, Cain and Abel doesn't rise to that level.
Right, that's just more of anger, vengeance, violence. And it got me thinking too. I'm teaching Disciple 1 right now, and tonight is our third lesson. We're talking about sin, Adam and Eve, the fall of humanity. And, you know, is Adam and Eve and the eating of the fruit, is that a betrayal of God's trust, or is that just disobedience? Like, where is disobedience and turn into betrayal, I guess would be the question.
And see, I think that's disobedience because to me, betrayal indicates one, some kind of, some premeditation. Like it's like a true betrayal. And I could be wrong here, but it feels like that you're intentionally harming or turning your back on somebody for some other, like for some kind of gain. Like if you think it's going to gain you something else. Now, maybe you put it in that term, so maybe Adam and Eve, that is a betrayal.
Yeah,
because we're going to gain knowledge of, you know, we're going to be like God. We're going to gain something.
Right. And you know, the more I thought about it, too, I think that I guess, you know, if it was a spur of the moment, that can still be a betrayal. Because you're going against your loyalties, and they were loyal to God to say, you know, yes, we're going to be given this, and God gave them the gift of the garden and told them everything they're, you know, supposed to do in that, and then they turned around and, you know, both of them are complicit. Adam is sitting right there, or standing right there. He could have said, you know, Eve, we should not do this, but he's silent and lets Eve eat, and then he takes a bite himself. So, you know, both of them are in on it. We're not going to have a debate between, you know, who is at more fault. But,
yeah.
I kind of see it as a betrayal between humanity and God in that moment.
I do like the idea that, as I thought about it, premeditation is probably not part of that. But I do think a betrayal happens when there's an assumption of loyalty.
Yes, I think loyalty is definitely involved in some type of betrayal. Because then that brings up another one, is Peter betraying Jesus when he denies him? Is that another sense of a betrayal because there was loyalty?
Well, yeah, I almost feel like maybe I'm wrong here, and I'm sure like as soon as I say it, I'll think of a reason why I'm wrong in this point. But it feels like a betrayal has to have a cost for the betrayed. You know, like there has to be some kind of like for example with Judas, there was a cost to Jesus.
Right, Jesus is then crucified, sends him into that line of, or that path.
And Peter's denial of Jesus really has no real impact on, because whether Peter had told the truth there or not, they were still going to crucify Jesus.
Okay, yeah.
And what Peter said in that moment wasn't going to change the course of events. It might have added a fourth cross to the crucifixion, because they might have strung Peter up at that point.
Right.
But it doesn't feel like if it's a betrayal, it's a different kind of betrayal than Judas's betrayal. So I put that in a different category. So it doesn't feel kind of have that feel of, and I think if they wanted to be seen as equivalent, I think the biblical writers would have said, and Peter also betrayed Jesus.
Right. Yeah.
But they use the word denied. So Peter denied Jesus.
Right. So, to take that logic then back to Adam and Eve, then there was a result of being betrayed because they were kicked out of the garden, removed, cursed in Genesis chapter 3. So there would have been a result that impacted that moment.
Right. And it did actual damage to relationship.
Right.
So I think Peter's the fallout there was Peter's own internal struggle about that.
Okay. Yeah. Well, let's switch here now and talk about kind of some ways this lives out in real life.
My real life lesson is trust no one.
Especially if he's got a nickname Littlefinger.
Yeah, especially Littlefinger. Or if they're an ambitious, despotic young monarch.
Yes. Never trust a king in his teens.
No. That's a recipe for disaster.
Do we have any idea how old David was when the Bathsheba thing went down?
Short answer, no, but I love to speculate.
Yeah. Sounds like a very early 20s decision.
That's before like full frontal lobe development happens.
Right.
David is being guided by another force.
Right.
And like many men have, and you know, I don't want to generalize here because women can get themselves in this kind of situation too. I'll say many people. Many people, okay, it's a Game of Thrones series, so I'm going to be a little bit crass here. Many people have made really, really bad decisions when they are guided by their genitalia.
Oh, yes.
And then you find yourselves in a, you find yourself in a situation, and think part of, and I'm actually going to move to something really serious here, that one of the struggles people have in our culture is that we kind of reduce sex to just the physical act. And, you know, I think people are sometimes caught off guard or surprised by the emotional baggage and spiritual damage that promiscuous sexuality can create in somebody's life. And so David was, you know, being driven by his lust, and then found himself in a situation that had no easy solution. And so I think in that regard, you know, the idea that, and it can lead us to betray, like lust, you know, I think of, you know, husband and wives cheating on each other. That's a deep betrayal.
Oh, yeah.
And driven by, you know, lust.
Yeah. Well, I think you take any of the seven deadly sins, they can lead to some type of betrayal.
Right.
I mean, we look around our world now, greed, I think, is leading to tons of betrayal when CEOs and boards don't care about their workers anymore and lay them off when they get close to retirement so they don't have to pay retirement, or, you know, all the different ways that corporate America kind of, you know, takes advantage of people and betrays all the work that they've put in and then just cuts them free.
Right.
You can see that all the time.
Yeah.
So I really think sin can lead to some type of betrayal, no matter which one it is.
But yeah, and I do think like everything in me is like deeply opposed to being melodramatic. Mm. Like I try my best not to just engage in drama of any kind. And you know, I have seen people who like are very quick to claim that they were betrayed or stabbed in the back when, you know, over minute things, small things. Mm-hmm. So I think we have a culture that doesn't handle disappointment or grievances very well. And so I think sometimes we can see betrayal when it's not there. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I do think, like you said, that kind of betrayal definitely exists. The kind of betrayal we're talking about does exist. I think so much of it is when we view people not as equal partners or people who are equal to us, but we view them as objects or means to an end. Mm-hmm. I think that's when betrayal happens to us. Like when we have something we want, you know, maybe it's a promotion or, you know, or whatever it is. I don't know. When, you know, a certain scenario or a certain outcome that we want, and we see that either somebody's in the way or we can use somebody, manipulate somebody to get something we want more than we actually want to love that person.
Yeah.
And to me, that's kind of at the heart of betrayal, is like dehumanizing someone else or putting someone else in harm's way or abusing someone else for the sake of something else we want more.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, to circle back, though, I think since we are both on the tail end of Gen X and being kind of in between, this might stir up a little controversy on our Facebook page, but two of the whiniest generations, the boomers and millennials, who are...
They're the worst.
But, I mean, that sense of being betrayed, we see this all the time when it may not actually be there, I think is an interesting thought.
See, I don't know. I think Gen X and the millennials were betrayed by the boomers. I mean, and when you talk about that kind of generalizations, I mean,
right? There's not.
I don't think my dad betrayed me. He's a boomer, but no. I do think kind of like we're starting to see. I think in some real ways, the result of kind of like a baby boomer hyper-individualism and kind of insistence on instant gratification.
Mm-hmm.
And boomers, and okay, you opened up a can here, Jim.
No. You brought it up first, and my mind just went to it. So I'm not taking all the blame. Don't betray me, Wes.
The boomer mentality of, like, they're the first people to experience anything.
Right.
This idea that everything has to be about them. So, like, every commercial I see on TV now is about, like, retirement.
Mm-hmm.
Or, like, a prescription medication for people over 60.
Yeah.
I'm like, y'all, the world does not revolve around you. So, but anyway, I think that kind of sense of generational betrayal, I think it is really easy to kind of like use that as an excuse or a crutch.
Mm-hmm.
Like to, you know, I know there are instances of like, there are people, you know, companies who are hiring people who kind of, you know, aren't hiring millennials or whatever, but I also get the feeling that, you know, there are a lot of young people who feel like they ought to climb the ladder much faster than they actually should.
Oh, yeah.
And so I think, if anybody wants to complain about betrayal in our country today, it's African Americans and Native Americans.
Yes.
Very few minorities can complain. And to some extent, obviously, women as a whole can complain, but really as a group in the aggregate, white men cannot be complaining about betrayal.
We're the ones who do the most of it, if not 99% of it.
And if anybody's betraying us, they learned it from us.
Yeah. So, you're exactly right. I mean, we're the ones that, because we're both white men, middle-aged white men.
Sounds depressing.
Yeah. Sorry. Little reality check, but yeah, I mean, there's a lot of victimhood, I think, in our culture now too, and you know, realizing that my gender and my race caused many of these issues that we are now, you know, having to deal with as society, right. I think is something we need to come about and to admit some of the betrayals that we've made as a culture. And as a gender and as a race. And it needs to come from us, because if not, then it's not genuine whatsoever. I don't think any growth can come from it whatsoever.
And before we end the episode, I do want to kind of take it, you know, that's a fascinating discussion about generations and, you know, groups of people. But to take it down to like a personal discipleship level, I think a lot of times what is experienced as or understood as betrayal usually happens as a result of a lack of communication, like a lack of honest communication.
Mm-hmm.
Like all of us, whether we want to or not, all of us are forced to make, we have to make decisions.
Right.
And obviously if you're, you know, in the workplace, if you have any kind of leadership wherever you work, I mean, if you have to lead people, you have to make choices. And sometimes those choices are received well, sometimes they're not. But if you're not communicating kind of your motivation, then that can be received as betrayal. And also, if you're being dishonest, or like you said earlier, greedy or self-centered in your decision making, it's going to lead you to betray people,
mm-hmm.
especially if you're in a position of leadership. And so I think kind of the fruits of the spirit in some ways, can help us kind of not be, can kind of lessen our chances of actually betraying people, and just kind of values that the kind of what we see in Jesus Christ himself, values of integrity and honesty. And here's the risk you run. Whenever you're in relationship with anybody, there is always a risk of being betrayed.
Yeah. Or, because of a decision you made or because of something that came up, the feeling that you betrayed somebody when it may not have been a betrayal to begin with.
Right.
You know, anybody, like you said, in leadership positions or in any type of relationship, when the decision's made, somebody might not feel like that decision was made with their best interests in heart and feel betrayed in that.
And, we could take it down the road of marriage. Like, there are going to be times when you feel like kind of the edges of that betrayal. And I'm not talking about like affairs or whatever.
Mm.
Like that's a whole other ball of wax. I'm referring more to like, there are decisions that we make, you know, that are, you know, decisions I've made that are selfish decisions when I wasn't thinking of my wife.
Mm-hmm.
And it can be received as betrayal. So I think part of that, I think honest communication is a helpful way to, you know, minimize the risk of betrayal. Right. And I honestly don't think the answer is to not trust anyone. In fact, I'm guilty probably of being too trusting of people. But if my alternative is to be completely cynical, I'll take the trusting piece.
Yeah, I completely agree. I usually give everyone the benefit of the doubt, or try to give people the benefit of the doubt and trust them. And I mean, I've been betrayed in my ministry and my life by parishioners and individuals, and I never look back going, oh, I wish I thought, you know, I wish I just never trusted them. I wouldn't go back and, you know, look at those relationships or those moments and kind of go, nope, I should have been more cynical or more hard. And, you know,
I might say I should have been smarter.
Yes.
Or I should have been more proactive. Usually I wound up feeling like somebody betrayed me when I haven't done the work I need to do to build a relationship or to resolve a conflict.
Yeah, and I think you're exactly right about communication. If people are honest with what they're actually feeling and what they're dealing with in a relationship, that turns into, you know, when decisions are made, you know, you can kind of understand why those things, why they decided what they decided.
Exactly.
But if you're holding it inside and not sharing that, then, you know, no one's going to see it, and then you make a decision and they don't know the motives behind that decision.
Right.
Well, all right. I think that is a good episode on betrayal. I mean, like, it's the heart of Game of Thrones. It is all over the Bible. It is all over our lives, and it's just a fact of life. And like I said, if we're more open, we can kind of work through those situations a little bit better than some of the characters in Game of Thrones.
Yeah, guys, betrayal's the heart of Game of Thrones. What a, like, thinking about that, like, man, that's bleak.
But I think it's some of it.
I love it. I mean,
I wouldn't say it's the only theme in there.
But, you know, the heart of Game of Thrones is kind of black and withered and rotten. So.
Yes. Yeah. All right. Well, next week we're talking about wisdom, and so we look forward to that conversation. So thanks a lot, Wes.
Thank you, Jim.
We appreciate you all listening to this episode, and we want to continue the conversation with you. Do you agree with what was said, or do you have any questions? Join us on our Facebook page at facebook.com/theologyof and continue the conversation there. You can also email us at theologyofpodcast@gmail.com. If you don't mind, please leave us a rating and a review on whatever platform you're listening to us on. And if you enjoyed this episode, share it with some friends or post it on your social media page. That'll help us get the word out about what we are doing in here and how much you are enjoying it. We'd like to thank again the composer of our theme music this season, Dustin Shelton. I am Jim Parsons. On behalf of Wes Smith, we'd just like to thank you once again for listening to The Theology Of.